This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And we're going to start today in Germany. The sound of protesters in Berlin last night chanting "Everyone against fascism." And that's because today members of the German parliament are debating a new law tightening the rules on immigration. Legislation tabled by the main opposition conservatives, the CDU, that can only pass with the support of the far-right Alternative for Germany party. Other parties, and indeed some in the CDU, say that would shatter what's become known as the firewall, the understanding in place since the end of the Second World War that the main party shouldn't do business with the far right. But there are elections next month, and polls suggest immigration is the top worry for voters. While an MP for Germany's ruling centre-left Social Democrats, Jens Zimmermann, told the BBC that the leader of the CDU, Friedrich Merz, was employing a dangerous strategy.
Without any need, he is now, Friedrich Merz, trying to make this election about migration. And again, making elections about migration is always supporting the populist and the far right. So I think this will be a historic mistake for the Conservative Party here in Germany.
Well, live to Berlin to talk to our correspondent, Damian McGuinness. And Damian, I'm just looking up at my monitors here, the scene from the Bundestag, that debate going on. But it took a while to get going. What was the holdup?
Yeah, we've had a dramatic day here in Berlin, James. And the holdup was really because the debate was put on pause as parties gathered together to try and figure out what to do. So you had two things happening. Party leaders were trying to get their MPs on side because the Conservatives have seen a bit of a rebellion. Some centrists within the Conservative Party have said they're not going to support Friedrich Merz's hardline strategy on migration and his acceptance of support, de facto acceptance of support from the far-right AfD for this particular bill. And on the other hand, also, parties have been wrangling with each other to see if they can come up with some agreement which would again push the AfD to the side. But of course, we've got 3 weeks to an election. And so those talks within parties appear to have broken down. And looking now at the debate, which has resumed, it's more polarised and more ferocious than ever. I mean, it's hard for me to remember having seen such a fierce debate in the Bundestag. People are shouting, people are red-faced, people are jeering, people are clapping, people are stamping their feet. You know, this Bundestag used to be a very calm, sedate place. Those days are over. We're now facing a very polarised political debate in Germany. And what we're potentially seeing, James, is if this firewall, which keeps the far-right AfD out of power, we're also seeing a potential breakdown of the traditional coalition-building system of consensus here in Germany. So this week is going to have far-reaching implications for the way Germany does politics looking forward.
And Damian, just briefly, if you can, I mean, how controversial is the actual legislation, or is it just the manoeuvring that's upset people?
Well, yeah, the manoeuvring is what's brought people to the streets, but the actual legislation is also very, very controversial, and some of the measures being suggested by the Conservatives are drastic, to say the least. Many critics would say that some of those measures, which we were talking about earlier this week, including shutting all of Germany's borders, all of Germany's land borders to all asylum seekers, are A, not practicable, B, not legally possible, and C, would undermine other EU agreements. So there's lots of criticisms to the actual content of the debate. And of course, migration anyway, at the best of times, is a very heated topic, which people have very, very strong opinions on. And it does get emotional very quickly, especially 3 weeks before an election, as we heard earlier. Friedrich Merz, for some reason, has decided to make this his top topic, which some people think, you know, whether it's a mistake or not, I think we'll see on February 23rd, we have an election. But it's certainly a risky strategy. That's for sure.
Damian, many thanks. The BBC's Damian McGuinness in Berlin. Well, let's speak to Philip Lengsfeld, who is an MP for the CDU, the Conservatives, between 2013 and 2017. He resigned from the party over a separate issue 18 months ago and joins us live also from Berlin, from the Bundestag. Mr. Lengsfeld, welcome to NewsHour. Just first of all, what are you hearing from your former colleagues? Is this legislation they've put forward going to pass, do you think?
As Damian already alluded to, it's high drama in the Bundestag. I would say it's democracy at work. Yeah, we are finally having true debates. It's about content. It's about majorities, and it's about who will finally get his will. And there's a strong urge on the liberal conservative side for changing our migration policies. And those forces have a majority in the Bundestag, and I'm optimistic that it will be tight, but the legislation will pass.
And how comfortable are you with the party relying on the Alternative for Deutschland support to get these measures through?
Well, it's not about a feeling of comfort. In my view, it's about making politics. And I never understood the logic, or I could understand the tactics of the lefties saying you are not allowed to pass legislation with this other party, but it doesn't make any sense. The conservatives, the liberals, the AfD and Sarah Wagenknecht, they have a majority and they have reasons for doing policy changes, and let's do it.
Right, so I mean, that suggests you are comfortable with the CDU effectively doing business with the far right.
I'm absolutely in favor of ending this blockage from the left side of the house for things we need to do. We need to fix migration. We need to fix energy. We need to fix security. There are so many things having been blocked over years by now that I'm not only comfortable, I'm absolutely in favor.
Right. So you're also happy with smashing that firewall, that long-standing taboo about the far right in German politics?
Well, I frankly, James, I hate the very word of it. What does firewall actually mean? And they actually, in the debate, they try to sort of substantiate this terrible thing. The SPD chief whip even said gate to hell. I never understood that. Yeah, we are talking about a democracy. Yes, there's right conservative policies and there are left conservative policies. But how on earth can you say you are tabooed to even think, to even discuss, let alone to pass legislations which is not green left? Yeah, I never understood that.
But isn't it the taboo of the influence of the far right, especially given Germany's history? Just one final thought. I mean, is there a danger that by trying to outflank the far right, people in the election may well say, look, I'll just vote for the real thing. Why would I vote for the CDU or just vote for the actual far right?
I think this is likely going to happen, but I don't think it will hurt the conservatives, it will hurt the SPD and the Greens, because after this debate, people will say it is important that the liberal conservatives have a majority to end this blockage, and to end this taboo of even being allowed to think about better policies for more security and controlled migration in this country.
Thank you very much indeed for your time today. That was Philippe Lengsfeld there. 3 years of war and Russia's occupation of a huge chunk of Ukrainian territories left more than 60,000 people missing. Some are soldiers, but many others are civilians, detained by Russian forces and then disappeared. And while Ukraine sometimes gets its POWs back, missing civilians are very rarely returned by Russia. Sarah Rainsford met one woman, desperate to know what happened to her parents after Russians seized control of their town.
Every morning they were apart. Tatiana sent a video message to her only child. She and her husband were living under Russian occupation in southeastern Ukraine. And their daughter was worried. Людмила shows me a phone full of those messages and of memories. One is her dad's 50th birthday in life before the Russians invaded. In all the images, Tatiana and Oleg are full of laughter and life. But in September 2023, they were detained by Russian soldiers and disappeared. Людмила's gran saw it all as armed men dressed in black burst into their home and took Tatiana and Oleg away in handcuffs. For 4 months, there was no trace of them. Then one day, Tatiana was abandoned at a hospital in a coma. She never regained consciousness.
It's just so tough to think what they did to her. My mom was 51. She loved life.
Ludmila's father has still not been found. When the Russian army first rolled into Melitopol, Ludmila joined the protests, telling the troops to go home. Then the Russians began rounding them up. Ludmila fled, but her parents stayed. Tatiana was convinced that Ukrainian troops would retake their city soon and liberate them.
To me, she's a warrior. She knew the risks, but she had to help.
Ludmila now knows her mother was charged with espionage, but only after she was dumped at hospital, unconscious.
Зинаїда Олександрівна, підкажіть, будь ласка, дату вашого народження.
This is not an isolated case. In Kyiv, the Red Cross runs a helpline, and most people calling have missing relatives too, soldiers and civilians. But a tracing system can only work with information. And although international law says both sides in a war have to inform about all detainees, Russia just doesn't do that. Mm-hmm.
Смог Леонид позвонить отцу и сказать, где он.
Sometimes the missing do turn up.
Увидел, конечно, в истощенном.
This is Anna, whose son Леонид also went missing in Melitopol. And after 3 months, he too was left at a hospital, extremely thin and dehydrated.
Леня мне рассказал, что.
His mother managed to speak to him then, and Леонид told her he'd been in hell. Леонид then disappeared again. He just turned up a whole year later, but on trial in Russia for espionage. From stories like this, Ludmila suspects her mother too was tortured. But Leonid's story is also a reason for hope that somehow, somewhere, Ludmila's father is also in a Russian basement or a prison cell, still waiting to be found. I couldn't save my mum, she tells me. And that is so hard. But I still have my dad, and I need to save him.
Sarah Rainsford reporting there from Ukraine. You're listening to NewsHour. Still to come on the programme, a mountain in New Zealand has just been given the legal rights of a person after a long campaign by the local Maori community.
There is a deep cultural, spiritual connection. Our mountain has been here through many things that our ancestors experienced, but it's also a living environment. You know, the waters come from our mountain. So there is a deep sense of life.
More on that in just over half an hour. Let's just recap our main headlines today. Uganda says it's strengthening its military positions in the eastern Congo, where an advance by Rwandan-backed rebels has raised fears of a wider regional war. More on that in about 15 minutes. And as we've been hearing, the man likely to be Germany's next chancellor is pushing for tighter immigration laws, despite uproar that he may depend on votes from the far-right AfD. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, was a shortage of staff to blame for the air crash above Washington, D.C. on Wednesday night? 67 people died when a military helicopter collided with a passenger jet coming into land at Reagan National Airport. At the time, only one controller was handling local plane and helicopter traffic rather than the usual two. Sean Pruchnicki is a former pilot who's landed at the airport many times. What's his assessment?
From everything that I've heard and seen, there doesn't seem to be anything unusual at all. In fact, it seems to be business as usual, with one exception, that there was one controller working two separate frequencies. That's very unusual. That's not what you would expect at such a high density, busy airport such as this.
At a news conference at the White House yesterday, Donald Trump blamed diversity employment policies at the Federal Aviation Administration for the crash. But Democrats pointed to the president's recent action, sacking the head of the Transportation Safety Administration and dismantling the Aviation Security Committee, as well as imposing a hiring freeze which could affect air traffic control staff. In addition, the FAA was leaderless at the time of the crash because the former boss quit after a row with Elon Musk. Well, the BBC's Carl Nasman's at Reagan National Airport and joins me now. And Carl, is, first of all, that issue of staffing at air traffic control the main line of inquiry at the moment?
It's going to be one of them. What NTSB officials, this is the federal agency in charge of this investigation, what they've been saying is, you know, they'll leave no stone unturned. They'll be looking at staffing issues. They'll be looking at communication, of course, between those air traffic controllers and the two different aircraft involved in this collision. And they're also going to be combing through a lot of the physical evidence, too. We know that in just the last few hours or so, those black boxes have been recovered from the American Airlines plane. These are data recorders. They contain crucial information. They should also have audio recordings of the actual conversations between the pilot and co-pilot. We were actually speaking with some of those officials a little bit earlier, and they said they've already started the process of beginning to extract the information from those boxes. And they'll be looking at the wreckage itself. There are some reports that they hope to take the remains of the aircraft that are still out there in the Potomac River. Just through the windows, we can see that river here from the terminal where we are. They're hoping to remove that then from the river, and that will be obviously a crucial step in terms of taking a look at the actual aircraft themselves and seeing if they can get any sorts of clues from what they see there.
And Carl, I see that Donald Trump has taken to social media again to talk about what happened. What's he been saying?
Yeah, he put out another post on his Truth social media platform about an hour or so ago, and he was talking about the altitude of the helicopter. He was saying that it was flying too high, that it should have been under about 200 feet. And, you know, there are some restrictions, of course, when it comes to air traffic here in Washington. It is such a busy sky here. It's not unusual to look around the capital city, and you see military helicopters going around, kind of zipping this way and that, and they're usually flying at a pretty low altitude. That's a safety thing. It's exactly so you don't see these sort of mid-air collisions. They're low enough so that they're going underneath the passenger planes that are landing at the various different airports here. There's two airports within 30 miles of each other where we are. We're only about 5 miles away from the White House, and we're right by the Pentagon. So that gives you a sense of the kind of congestion that the airwaves here can see. So Donald Trump kind of talking about that, but, you know, he seemingly laid the blame at the feet of many different factors here in his different press conferences, in his different social media posts, talking about these DEI diversity programs, but not really providing any evidence of why that might have affected things. So right now, this is in the hands of federal investigators. They're going to be looking at the details. We're not expecting a final conclusion. We'll get some preliminary evidence soon, but this could take months, even a year.
Carl, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Carl Nasman joining us live from Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C. Well, among the 67 victims of the plane crash were six members of the Boston Skating Club returning from a training camp in Kansas. Let's speak to Doug Zegheib, who's the CEO of the club. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today on NewsHour. And a devastating loss to your club. How are you all feeling today?
I think it's still settling in and sinking in. Yesterday was a pretty rough day, both in trying to understand what happened and in learning that there were no survivors. And I think the severity of that and the intensity of that is slowly sinking in across our community. We have about 1,100 members. And we're just going to work on figuring this out on a day-by-day basis.
And tell us about those that you lost.
Well, I'll start with the coaches, Vadim and Jenya, two coaches that came to us from Connecticut in 2017. They were trained in St. Petersburg, Russia. They were world pair champions while representing Russia in 1994, immigrated to the U.S., and then came to the club and have developed kids from the ground up, kids taking their very first steps on the ice all the way up to Team USA competitions and international events, including their son, Max. And then our two kids who were lost and their moms. The kids were fantastic, highly talented, which is why they were invited to this camp. Definitely the future of the sport in the eyes of U.S. figure skating, and certainly in the eyes of those of us here in Boston. And their moms, such incredible supporters, not only of the kids, but of our own community. It truly is a significant, significant loss.
And Doug, is your club and skating more broadly, I mean, is it a pretty tight-knit community?
I didn't realize how tight-knit it is. I certainly knew our community was tight-knit, but I've been receiving literally hundreds of messages, texts, voicemails, emails, I can't keep up with it, from around the world, certainly from around the country, but from around the world, in the UK, in Switzerland, the home of the International Skating Union, as far away as Japan. Skating is a tight-knit global community, without a doubt.
And how are you going to allow people in your club to grieve? How have people been responding?
I think it truly is still sinking in with folks. We had a get-together at our club last night for a couple of hours. It was heavily attended. We're going to do another one this evening. Really just a moment, an opportunity for club members to come together and to grieve and to just share. I think I'm really understanding how important that is for folks. So we're supporting our members in that way.
Doug, as you say, it is a time for grieving, but I would like to ask you this. I mean, the investigation's still ongoing, as we just heard. We don't know exactly what happened, what caused this mid-air collision. But President Trump has made it pretty clear where he thinks the blame lies, while pointing the finger in several directions. I mean, what do you make of his comments and the fact that he keeps taking to social media or using news conferences to say what he thinks happened?
Well, I actually think that's President Trump's job, is to get to the truth of what happened here and then to explain it to, you know, folks here and around the world. That certainly isn't our job. Our job is to support these families, survivors of these families, and then to wait for the actual understanding of what really happened here. But, you know, I can't fault President Trump for doing his job.
I mean, isn't he meant to be just consoling the nation rather than putting forward his theories?
Well, I saw a statement from him yesterday that actually, to me, was a flag that there were no survivors on the plane when he said, God bless their souls. That was pretty kind and good to read. It was also, like I said, a signal that, okay, he has early information that there are no survivors.
Yeah, okay. Doug, we'll have to leave it there. But thank you very much indeed for coming onto the program today. Doug Zegheib, CEO of the Boston Skating Club. You're listening to NewsAd. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up. Welcome back to NewsAd. Some good news for conservation efforts in India now, because a new study has found that the number of tigers there has doubled in just over a decade. There are now 3,600. That's three quarters of all the world's tigers. And crucially, they're doing well with less habitat compared to other countries and while living in the most densely populated country on Earth. Well, the study is published in the journal Science, and its lead author is Dr. Yadvendra Dave Jala. So what explains the increase?
Mostly tigers were limited by poaching. So poaching was controlled in India. Secondly, policies have been changed. So prey restoration has happened, creating space for tigers by voluntary incentivized relocation of people from protected areas. And this has been the crux of tiger conservation, because you need space for biodiversity. And if there are people everywhere, then biodiversity cannot survive, especially not apex carnivores.
And do you think in that time, people's attitudes towards tigers have changed?
The culture and religion of Indians has been quite tolerant traditionally towards all life forms, including large carnivores. There are huge conflicts with carnivores. We lose about 35 people annually to tiger predation. But now buffer zone areas around tiger reserves get benefits from the gate receipts of tiger reserves. Incentivized voluntary relocation gives a good package of about $22,000 per adult in the family. And there is a lot of tourism potential for tigers through employment in hotels and that kind of stuff. And most livestock predation is compensated by the government.
And where the tigers aren't necessarily in strictly protected areas, have they adapted to live alongside humans, do you think?
So tigers minimize their overlap with humans, you know, and about 40% of our tigers share space with about 60 million people. But that is only possible if lands are spared as protected areas.
One interesting aspect of the study is that you found that they did do better in more prosperous parts of India rather than poorer parts of India. Is that right?
Absolutely right. So when the economy is low, people depend on forest resources and especially bushmeat consumption that depletes prey populations. And as soon as prosperity comes in, then livelihoods change to other forms of livelihood, which are conducive to recovery of biodiversity and tigers.
It's still quite a small population. Is the gene pool big and healthy enough, do you think, looking ahead to the future?
The tigers of India are the most diverse tigers, according to genomic studies. Of course, there are restrictions when there is no gene flow between isolated populations due to human reasons. But currently, we don't have any genetic problems in any single population. And animals are moving across human-dominated landscapes to exchange genetic material between different populations. Because we have connecting corridors of habitats, which are maintained sacrosanct, and any developmental activity which happens there happens with mitigation measures so that there is animal passageways which can cross them. You know, by protecting the tiger, you're actually protecting the ecosystem services and ecological security for future generations on the planet.
And that was Dr. Yadvendra Dev Jala speaking to me about that new study published this week in the journal Science. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Well, let's turn to what's happening in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo now. A rapid advance by a group of rebels called M23 that's already seized control of the region's biggest city, Goma, and now has its sights set on another big population centre, Bukavu. The Congolese government accuses Rwanda of supporting and fighting alongside the rebels, of being an occupying force that's trying to foment regime change. More from then in a moment, and from Rwanda, which insists it's simply defending its border. But the conflict's drawing in all sorts of other countries, including Uganda and South Africa, raising fears of a much bigger war. The fighting's already cost countless lives and forced hundreds of thousands of people to flee their homes. Many of them are heading into Rwanda. The BBC's Paul Ngie is at the Gisenyi border, crossing on the Rwandan side.
Hundreds of people are coming into the Gisenyi border, that's on the Rwandan side of the border with the DRC. And what we saw this morning were people eager to seek safety. They were being checked by border patrol officials and sniffer dogs to ensure that they were indeed real travelers, of course, because they had to do security clearances. But also what we noticed today was that while there are some who are coming into Rwanda, there are others who are making the trip back into the Democratic Republic of Congo. Some of them we spoke to told us that they feel that the situation is a little bit calmer now and that it's time they returned home. Basically, it's a mix of both those who are coming in and those who are leaving. But from our observation, those who were on the queue to come in were far higher than those who were going back to the DRC.
Right, so more people fleeing the DRC than going back. And how far away is the crossing where you are? How far away from the fighting are you?
Well, we are at the one-stop border point, which is a couple of minutes away. But once you've crossed that border and you keep going into Goma, you're likely to start entering the territory. But of course, the people we spoke to, some told us that they took about a day on road just to leave from their villages, walk and come out of those areas to get into Gisenyi, where we are.
And what, people fleeing with just a few possessions that they could grab on their way out?
That's right. Some people were just carrying their belongings on their heads, wrapping some of their clothes in loins. Others were moving with buckets, holding children in their hands and arms. Basically, they were distraught, but hopeful that they had found shelter. I spoke to one woman this morning who said that her husband was killed as a result of the offensive in Goma, and she's not sure when she's ever going to return to the country. And I think that really speaks about the dire situation back in Goma and the hope for people for the conflict to come to an end as soon as possible, for life to return to normal.
The BBC's Paul Ngie on the border between Rwanda and the DRC. Well, let's hear from the Congolese government now. This is what the country's foreign affairs minister, Therese Kayikwamba-Wagner, told my colleague James Copnell on Newsday earlier today.
Our message to the world is that the Democratic Republic of the Congo is being illegally occupied by Rwanda. This is the clear result of decades of impunity and of not holding President Kagame accountable for his flagrant violations and his disregard for international law. The issue that we're looking at right now is a dramatic humanitarian situation. The main city in North Kivu province, Goma, being occupied by Rwandan defense forces with, as a puppet, the M23, you know, a pretense of an armed group. And at the same time, also the Rwandan defense forces and de facto the Rwandan government backing, funding and equipping an insurgency that seeks to overthrow a legally established and elected government.
Rwanda, of course, has always denied sending its troops into your country, denied its support for the M23, even if the United Nations certainly backs up some of your claims. Well, M23 seems now to be heading towards another major city in the east of the DRC, Bukavu. Can you guarantee the Congolese people that your armed forces will be able to keep Bukavu out of M23's hands?
Of course, and it is out of question that we consider a scenario under which the M23 would advance further. Also, this goes hand in hand again with holding Rwanda accountable for what is clearly orchestrated regime change by Rwanda, a country that benefits of so much foreign aid. And this is the regime that the United Kingdom has been funding for the past three decades without holding them accountable for egregious human rights violations in their own country and other countries in the Great Lakes region.
So to be clear, what are you asking then of Britain, of America, of other Western countries? Is it to stop aid to Kigali? Is it something else? What do you want?
I think, first of all, aid should be stopped to Kigali. Secondly, there need to be sanctions targeting the command structure of the Rwandan Defense Forces, as well as the politicians that have been enabling this warfare in the Great Lakes region and in particular in the DRC. Also, I think that Rwanda ought to be under an embargo for all of its mineral exportations. They should not be benefiting from what has been mined illegally and under forced labor in the eastern DRC. Rwanda should also be suspended. This is a very important point. Suspended as a troop contributing country to United Nations peacekeeping missions. I want to remind you that in the past week, 17 peacekeepers were killed by the RDF and by the M23. Peacekeepers killed by Rwanda, which is one of the largest troop contributing country to United Nations peacekeeping missions. It is unacceptable. Rwanda is not a peacekeeping champion. Rwanda is a warmonger. We see it right now in eastern DRC.
The Foreign Affairs Minister of the DRC, Therese Kayikwamba-Wagner. Well, there was this response from the Rwandan government to President Paul Kagame. Here's spokeswoman Yolande Makolo talking to the BBC's Catherine Birahanga earlier today.
We are not interested in occupying anyone's land.
So what are your troops doing there in the DRC? What are your troops doing there?
Our troops are deployed along our border.
No, by all estimations, let's be clear with our listeners. By all estimations, your allies, the United States, the UK, the UN, the whole world says your troops are there in the DRC. Why are they there? And shouldn't you leave the DRC to manage its own affairs?
Well, they have failed to. They have failed to. We have had repeated violations of our border. We've had people killed on our side of the border with shelling coming from the DRC. Just this week, we've had 15 people died from stray bullets and bombing coming from what's happening in Goma. And this is not new. We have had to live with this. And because of that, we have deployed heavily defensive mechanisms and offensive mechanisms on our border to ensure that we keep our people safe.
So
and
just explain that to us. What are your troops doing? What is that offensive position there in the DRC? Because whether it's diplomatic, offensive position, I mean, that means you are actively fighting the Congolese government on its own territory.
No, we are ensuring that the fighting that is happening on few kilometers from our border do not come across, and ensuring that we prevent any spillover into Rwanda, because the decisions that are being made,
boots on the ground in the DRC, doesn't it? That's what it involves.
That means that if we have to counter any attacks that are targeted at us, it will not happen within our borders.
Yolande Makolo, who speaks for the Rwandan government. So what's the rest of the world doing about this conflict? A UN Security Council meeting a few days ago called for it to end, but offered no practical measures. Rwanda's allies have also called for an end to the fighting, and France's foreign minister flew to both Kinshasa and Kigali yesterday. The EU's foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, told the BBC the bloc was reviewing its relations with Rwanda.
Given the events over the last days, then the EU will need to look into reassessing our security and cooperation partnership with Rwanda and considering other steps. This is clear. I mean, we had on Monday the Foreign Affairs Ministers meeting where ministers urged Rwanda to halt its support for rebels and withdraw its troops. So clearly we need to look into our reaction here.
Let's speak to Jason Stearns, a former UN investigator in the DRC and an expert on the region at Simon Fraser University in Canada. Welcome again to NewsHour. Lots of words calling for a ceasefire, some criticism of Rwanda. How likely is it, do you think, that'll translate into concrete action?
I think that the past has shown us that Rwanda doesn't care too much about words. The United States, for example, including under President Biden, was criticizing and denouncing Rwanda's involvement in the DRC 2 years ago. And Rwanda has not changed course. So I think from past experience that there'll need to be material sanctions and consequences for Rwanda. In 2012, in a very similar situation, when rebels backed by Rwanda took Goma, the international community cut $240 million of aid to Rwanda. So, and that had a huge impact and actually led them to withdraw their troops. So my feeling is it will take something similar.
Why are some countries refraining from that sort of action, do you think?
I think there's several reasons. Rwanda has made itself very useful to certain partners. It deploys its troops in northern Mozambique, where it has protected a massive French oil installation worth $20 billion. It deploys troops in the Central African Republic, where it's a counterweight to Russian troops that are also deployed there. It's the second largest contributor of peacekeeping troops to the United Nations. So there's that element. I think there's also a hangover of guilt from the genocide, even though that's 1994, there are still leading members of the international community who feel that they have no right in criticizing Rwanda because they didn't do anything during the genocide in 1994.
There has been some suggestion that this isn't just about this bit of land next to Rwanda in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, that in fact it's about the whole of the country, that Rwanda's somehow seeking regime change. Is that credible?
Well, the spokesperson, the leader of the political wing of the M23 rebellion, he has made no secret of this. He says openly that they're seeking to overthrow the government in Kinshasa. The Rwandan ambassador to the region, Vincent Karega, in an interview 2 days ago, said something very similar. He said that the rebellion is seeking regime change in Kinshasa. And since the rebellion is really dominated by the Rwandan government, it's difficult to see them saying that without approval from the Rwandan government. So, yes, I think this is very serious. They'd have to walk, 2,000 kilometers across the country to overthrow the government. So this may not happen tomorrow, but their ambitions are very serious.
Meanwhile, just finally, I mean, again, other countries being drawn in. I mentioned South Africa, also Uganda today, talking about beefing up its military positions. What's its role, if you can, in 45 seconds?
Rwanda, also Burundi, we haven't talked about, but Uganda, I mean, has a very strange position. It's conducting joint operations in the Eastern Congo together with the Congolese government against a Ugandan armed group that's based there. And yet it is also complicit with the M23 rebellion. M23 rebels have come through their territory. They recruit there. And so it plays a strange, ambiguous position. And I think that this latest statement, therefore, should lead us to worry about them getting more involved in backing the M23.
Jason, as ever, thank you very much indeed for your analysis. That was Jason Stearns, expert on this region from Simon Fraser University in Canada. You're listening to NewsHour. Let's turn to Syria now and the question of who's going to run the country and how in the wake of the rebel offensive that swept away more than 50 years of Assad family rule. That offensive was spearheaded by Ahmed al-Sharaa, leader of the Islamist group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. And this week he was declared interim president of Syria by all the other military factions in that rebel alliance. That's led to some accusations of a power grab. And so last night, Mr. Sharaa gave a televised address promising to form an inclusive and diverse government to lead the country until elections could be held. Let's talk to Hayed Hayed, a consulting fellow with the Middle East and North Africa program at the Foreign Affairs think tank Chatham House. He's on the line now. Welcome to NewsHour. We've heard this message about an inclusive government before. Do Syrians believe him, do you think?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I think for now, many Syrians want to believe him because the alternative is quite bad. The country has just been through a lot for the past, not only 13 years of conflict, but before that, 5 decades under the control of that same regime. So they don't want to experience another war, another sort of dictatorship by a different person or a different sort of party.
Well, and on that, I mean, it was a bit awkward that he was anointed interim president by those other rebel groups. I mean, it might to some look like a military coup.
That's true. I think we have to understand the situation in order to have a better idea about why that action was taken. I think for al-Sharaa, he was in a position that was no sort of easy ways out of. He does not have any official position in Syria, yet everyone who is going to Syria is dealing with him as the de facto ruler. But he cannot continue doing that forever. So he initially wanted to have a national dialogue in which, or after which, he would be then positioned as the interim ruler of Syria. That did not happen. So the only way he was able to do so is by basically taking that legitimacy from the groups who led the offensive that led to the collapse of the regime. Whether that's the right move or not, I think it's basically what he tried to explain in yesterday's speech, where he alluded to the fact that lawyers told him that it's in a way the only sort of the best of like worst options for him.
Yes, I mean, he also talked about a 4-year transition. That's a long time, isn't it?
It is a long time, but when you look at the sort of the details of how you can move forward, analysts as well as observers and even Syrian experts, they tend to think that maybe 4 years might be too much, but it's going to be a long process, because if you look at the situation in Syria, you have no political parties, you have now no constitution, you have no parliament. So for the country that has been divided and did not have that much sort of say over how the country is run, to be able to enter a process that is inclusive and represent the ambition of different sort of components of the country, that will take time to be able to agree on a constitution, then be able to prepare for elections, allow people and parties to be created to establish themselves in order for fair and inclusive elections to take place.
Okay.
It's going to be a long process. But again, whether it's 4 years or less, that's still debatable.
Yeah. Hayed, thank you very much indeed. Hayed Hayed, consulting fellow with the Foreign Affairs think tank at Chatham House. Now, a mountain in New Zealand has this week been given the same legal rights as a person. Why? Well, the idea is to hand back what was called Mount Egmont by 19th century settlers to the indigenous Maori communities that live there, and to recognise the Maori worldview that things like mountains, as well as forests and rivers, are living beings, and indeed their ancestors. Under a new law passed on Thursday, it'll now be called Taranaki Maunga, or Mount Taranaki. Debbie Ngarewa is a member of the Taranaki Iwi, that's the local Maori kinship group. She's also an MP and co-leader of the political party Te Pāti Māori. What's her reaction to the new law passing?
It has been 150 years plus that we've seen this injustice in Taranaki. So there's a lot of emotions, a lot of relief, It was a really great time to lift the shackles and the heaviness of the denial of the history and the breach of justice. Most significantly, though, also look at the future, never having to fight for justice in something as important as our maunga, our mountain.
Can you explain how you regard the mountain, how you conceive of it?
There is a deep cultural, spiritual connection. Our mountain has been here through many things that our ancestors experienced, and actually even we have, as recent as a pandemic. But it's also a living environment. You know, the waters come from our mountain. So there is a deep sense of life.
And granting it the same rights as a person, I mean, do you believe it is a living entity, if you like?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, what we do see is life springing off our mountain. And when we don't look after and we don't keep our mountain well, it has an impact on the rest of us as a community. You only bow to a lofty mountain, and that's how we feel and have been raised culturally here as children of the mountain as well. So, absolutely.
So what will the law actually change in practice?
I think significantly we've been able to return to the Indigenous ancestral name of our mountain. But from a practical sense going forward, it means we're able to sit at the table and be a part of the solution. Our mountain hasn't been returned in a good state.
Really? So what's happened in previous decades then?
There's been horrible predators, there's all sorts of pests and eradication programs, which we now lead. But you will see big gaps where there used to be huge trees and forest and vegetation. There's been a lot of loss of native birds. So there's a real active program to replenish, eradicate and reset. And I think the locals here, Māori and non-Māori, look after our mountain better than the bureaucrats in cities, you know, 4 or 5 hours away. It also means that we're responsible for reinvigorating the stories, so when we have visitors, we can actually, with pride, take them to somewhere and show them not only the well-being of our mountain, but also the Indigenous history, the Māori history. It's been sorely missing.
Because as I understand it, there's a forest and a river in New Zealand that in the past were granted these rights of personhood. Yes. Has it made a difference?
Oh, absolutely has. I mean, Whanganui, the Whanganui River, which traditionally is known as Te Awa Tupua, has had a massive regeneration program and a reconnection.
And that was Debbie Ngarewa, who's a member of the Taranaki Maori group around Mount Taranaki, also leader of that Maori political party. And that brings us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. From me and the rest of the team, thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
to bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.